Many thanks to Antonio for his considerations and the witness also. And so now it's time to give the floor to Julian Pfeiffer, but just a few words to introduce him. He's many things together, I can say. He's an artist manager, a producer of concert and opera, and also a musician. Former cellist with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra that he founded in 1972. And he guided this ensemble, the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, for its first 18 years, and they performed in hundreds of cities on four continents. And Pfeiffer conceived his orchestra conduction in a very particular way that I think he will explain us, or today, or in another seminar we will have. In 2000, with composer and educator Bruce Adolf, Pfeiffer co-founded the Learning Maestros, a company dedicated to creating new works and related curricula that integrate music with other disciplines, including science, literature, history, and issues of social conscience. And Pfeiffer founded and ran the Venice Music Festival for 3 years, starting in 2004. Now, Julian serves as executive director of the Musicians for Human Rights. Many times we spoke of this, an organization founded in Rome by the Italian horn player Alessio Allegrini, with activities centered currently in Europe. The mission of Musician for Human Rights, I repeat what I said before, is to foster a culture of humanism through music. So, the floor to Julian. Thank you again to Julian.
It's okay. Thank you. Thank you, Carlotta. It's a lot of responsibility with everything you've said. First of all, greetings to all of you, and it's an honor to be given this opportunity to present these seminars on a very unusual topic, if a somewhat natural topic to us as musicians, this whole issue of music and human rights. First, I'd like to thank Professor Alessandro Pacaniella, the Vice Rector for International Affairs of the University, and I didn't realize I had a fellow musician sitting right here. I know about Professor Antonio Papisca's storied history with music and ongoing in his life, but I didn't know we also had an oboist. And if you push us really hard during these next few weeks, maybe the three of us could play a piece together. I don't know. Of course, thanks to Professor Marco Mascia for organizing this, and to Carlotta Sorba for helping to guide me and all of us. And then, of course, a very special thank you to Antonio Papisca. He closely questioned Alessio Allegrini and myself, and equally closely encouraged us to develop presentations based upon our experiences and practices. He saw relevancies and values that could advance the objectives of the master's degree course in human rights and multi-level governance. So all of us are looking forward to a lively and engaged exchange. And towards that, I'd like to ask Benedetta if you could just circulate this just one piece of paper that I will ask you all to make some notes on. And let me see if I can play a piece here. So I'd like to start with a piece of music. emotions, feelings, thoughts that can be associated with music. It does not express anything concrete in a certain sense. It is not descriptive of facts. Can you all hear me? Okay. And I'd like to review, and again, there's no right or wrong here, but I'd like to really review some of these feelings and some of the valences involved in listening to music that we all experience whenever we hear music. So here the first one is it sort of dance-like or still in sentiment? How many had dance-like? Good. And how many had still? Great.
Some.
Yeah. And it could be neither. And you could also state another sentiment that goes with dance or still. And what about it being serene? Yes or no? How many felt it was serene? Okay, and how many felt it was not serene? Okay, a little bit more feeling that it was not. And some of you don't seem to have hands. Now, of course, we're in a school of human rights. You know, hands are not needed. You could nod your heads. You could lift a foot. You could stand up or sit down. But it would be nice to get response from everyone, for everyone to participate. And, of course, you also don't have to participate. That's also your right. Does it evoke future time, present time, or past time? How many felt it's past time? And present? Okay. And future? Yes. And how about all tenses? Why not? Because that's also something that happens, because we're responding always only in the present. But it's bringing together memories and experiences. And in fact, Bruce Adolph, the composer, who will be giving one of the lectures, has written a piece inspired by the neuroscientist Antonio Damasio called Memories of a Possible Future. So it can span all tenses. Does this piece evoke a large space or a small space? What was the general sense? Yes?
Large.
Large. Others? Large. Anyone small?
Small.
And I guess I should be participating too, but maybe not before the fact. But for me it was actually small. Is the piece calm or tense? How many felt it was calm? And tense? Okay. I think there's a connection between calm and tense and answer of serene, yes or no in serenity. And by the way, there are studies that show, sociological and psychological studies that show how much our responses, even if we're doing this just one-on-one, no one else is in the room, are affected by the order in which questions are asked. It's a big influence. We'll talk about that more when we get into bias. Extrovert or introvert in feeling? Okay. Others? Is it a sense of it being an inter or exterior? Generally? Okay. Was this a piece with feeling of action or reflection?
Reflection.
Okay.
Reflection.
Happy, pleasant, sort of neutral, or sad? Would you say? What are some of the feelings there? Happy. One person. All of you don't look very happy, but that's something else. Sad. Pleasant or neutral? Okay. Is there a sense of melancholy or nostalgia in this piece? Yeah, a lot of you felt that.
And since this was too much of a binary form, and this is multi-level, are there other adjectives that come to mind that any of you want to state? Okay. Well, that's true. It shows that everyone has musical literacy, and everyone has feelings and thoughts and responses. They're not unanimous, as our tastes in food or dress or anything else are not unanimous, but there is considerable musical literacy, and there are some clear tendencies in a few of these categories that we went through. And the intensity of the feelings, you know, their breadth or narrowness, their simplicity or complexity, are often influenced by cultural familiarity, and in many cases somewhat limited to your primary cultural milieu. On the other hand, there's music from every culture that you might be inspired to dance to, even without understanding much about the sources of that music. But if it had a fast tempo, a well-articulated rhythm, you might be inspired to move, and if not, jump out of your seats. One of the themes in these seminars will be purposes of music and issues of local values and meaning, and perhaps in contrast to universal ones. Now, what you heard is written by Merima Clucho. She's an accordion player from Bosnia, now residing in California. As a child, she grew up in Sarajevo, enjoying the religious holidays with her friends that they celebrated in their synagogues, churches, and mosques. She never had conceived of religion as divisive, as a barrier. She only experienced the religious diversity as enrichment, an additional colorful characteristic, like different ingredients and styles of cooking food, or different clothes her friends would wear. She had to leave Sarajevo in 1994. Merima was displaced from her homeland, and I imagine is legally classified as a refugee. But I don't think she refers to herself that way. I think she calls herself a citizen of the world. Later today, by the way, you'll hear from another world citizen, Palestinian Ramzi Abu Redwan. His family was also displaced from their homeland, but they are not legally considered refugees because they are from Palestine and they live in Palestine. Back to the music by Merima. The piece is a fragment from a musical composition she wrote titled The Sarajevo Haggadah. It is a musical reflection on a Jewish Haggadah used in the Passover service that has traveled through many countries over the centuries and has been protected by people of many nations and many faiths, most significantly by Muslims from the Nazis and by Muslims from the bombardments of Sarajevo. The music is not religious or anti-religious or a-religious. It is only a constellation of sounds designed with clear, intense feeling, expertise both in composition and the capabilities of her instrument, the accordion, and created and performed with palpable dignity. Before we move on, I'm a little concerned that maybe the next time you hear Merima's name, you're going to have an association with nostalgia or sadness, or even with the word accordion, an association that's very specific to this recent experience. It will be a bias, the effect of what is known as anchoring, according to Nobel Prize-winning social economist Daniel Kahneman in his book Thinking Fast and Slow. So I want to play a rather contrasting piece this time, hopefully with video, so you can see Merima, titled Pajusko Oro. It's not pronounced properly. I'm sorry, I do not know what it means, but you'll have, I think, a different experience. that's the previous one. Maybe I, if it's not working, I will maybe play it from my laptop, and I can walk around so you can all see it. Just a moment. Just waiting for this to open, but I you know what?
No.
I'm gonna just. It's just not working. So I'm gonna just. Okay, I think we get a sense of what that piece is about, and perhaps a little more positive and outgoing and extrovert, and maybe you'll be more impartial or positively predisposed if her name comes up in the future. These seminars are going to be exploring ways to humanize the study of human rights, using the world of music as the principal catalyst for our considerations. This purpose, humanizing the study of human rights, might be surprising. After all, doesn't the field of human rights attract humanists? And the principal means, music, might also raise some eyebrows as well. Music is widely viewed today as a form of entertainment. But human rights is serious business. Ever since the inclusion of the phrase human rights in the United Nations Charter in 1945 and the subsequent Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, the academic study of human rights has been the domain primarily of the legal and political departments of universities. With a large body of declarations, conventions, and treaties of global, regional, and national institutions and agencies, with the significant role of NGOs, the impact and influence of transnational corporations, and the increasing number of rights defined as human rights, there are a lot of facts the student of human rights must absorb. You need to become an expert. But an expert in facts is not a goal. It is a prelude. It is an opportunity to discover relationships among the facts, between you and the facts, between you and others. Often underemphasized in education is the training of the individual student, of you, the aspiring or perhaps already practicing human rights professional, to recognize that you are an essential participant in the human enterprise, bearing the responsibility to bring your unique qualities and perspectives, your own voice, into your work, into your community, into our world. What does this mean, your own voice? It means questioning your perspective, examining your reflexes and biases, knowing your tendencies. Are you an optimist or pessimist, detail-oriented or the big-picture person? Do you miss seeing the forest because of the trees? Are you a leader or supporter? And the world needs both, for sure. How do you respond to paradoxes and contradictions? With curiosity or frustration or humor? Can you accept ambiguities and uncertainties? Or must everything be black or white? When you eat in a Chinese restaurant, which fortune cookie do you prefer to receive? Look before you leap, or nothing ventured, nothing gained. These tendencies and preferences are important facts, too, but they are internal facts. They are your facts and no one else's. They are part of your interior landscape and should be explored and understood by you. A recurrent theme during the seminar will be the importance of integrating perceptions and feelings with thinking, confronting yourself before you interact with others. Then, when you are bombarded with external facts, complexities, and unanticipated circumstances, you will be better prepared to respond creatively and profoundly with insights that advance human dignity. I want to read a brief poem in a book that also happens to be by the composer Bruce Adolph. And I think it's from a book titled What to Listen For in the World. And this poem is titled, Know Your Own Music First. Do you listen to your own voice? Do you know the tempo of your actions? Do you live by the beat or the phrase? Do you rush your own thoughts? Do you trust your intuition? Do you enjoy your dreams? Do you tap your foot nervously? Do you improvise your meals? Do you listen to the pulse of your own heart? Every year, music conservatories around the world produce many graduates, instrumentalists, singers, composers, who are technically excellent. They are virtuosos. They are expert. But they are not very interesting. They have very little to communicate. They might be exciting to listen to for a short time, just as it is thrilling to take a roller coaster ride. But how often can you enjoy a roller coaster? Why are these excellent performers not interesting? Because they have not found their own voice. In New York recently, I met with an esteemed violin professor at the Juilliard School, one of the leading music conservatories in the world. She told me that some of her students practice by watching YouTube videos of the violinists that they admire, their favorite violinist, trying to imitate exactly what they do. This is mindless and it's soulless. Indeed, music conservatories face the same challenges in advanced training as do human rights centers. In the case of the music student, it is the necessity to learn so much music, so many techniques of practicing and playing your instrument. There is a constant drive for perfection. But perfection of what and for what purpose? The correct notes and pitches, the correct tempo and speed, the correct rhythm, the correct sound and color and volume and intensity, the correct articulation, is it legato or staccato, the correct shape of the melody, the correct architecture of the entire work? Being expert in these things is not a goal. It is a beginning. I don't wish, of course, to undervalue the importance of technical excellence, of being a virtuoso with facts or with physical execution, and in many instances being perfect, or at least precise and consistent. If you drive a car and have an accident, most of the time you will be driving again soon. But if you pilot a plane and have an accident, you and the passengers are dead. We want and expect perfection in surgery. We need precision in compounding ingredients of medicines or in firing a missile. If you are a lawyer presenting in a courtroom, you need to be expert in the rules of procedure, or your arguments will not be reviewed on their merits. If you are in a choir, you know the importance of singing in tune, of matching color and volume with your colleagues, of proper pronunciation, of achieving the articulation and clarity of words your choral director requests, of breathing together. If you are a violinist sitting in the middle of the violin section of an orchestra, you must have the skills to follow the conductor and the leader of your section, to synchronize and support. Match the sounds with the bow, with the vibrato, make the same oral shapes. Perfect coordination can be beautiful, essential to success in an orchestra, in a dance company, on the soccer field, on the factory floor. Coordination means collaboration. It demonstrates understanding and respect. In evolutionary terms, coordination and cooperation, somewhat aided by our prefrontal cortex, led to the rise of human civilization, the formation of cities and nations, the creation of universities, to scientific advances, cures for many diseases, noble victories of good over evil, fine performances by dance companies, by orchestras, all wonderful achievements. But technical excellence can also breed a sense of superiority, of entitlement, of arrogance. It can make you impatient, indifferent to the best efforts of others, intolerant of the imperfections and messiness of so much of life. It can lead to or contribute to abuses of power. In the wrong hands, in the wrong minds, expertise combined with collaboration, cooperation can be harmful, criminal, poisonous, or deadly. My field is classical music. It's a confusing and imperfect name, classical music. It has so many meanings in so many different fields. In the study of Western civilization, you will associate it, of course, with the classics, in the study of ancient Greece and Rome and language, history, thought, philosophy. A classic movie generally refers to the great movies of the first 50 years of the 20th century. At least for my generation, for your generation, it might refer to any movie of the 20th century. A classic car conjures up specific images as well. Classical music is a genre known as art music, distinguished from folk, traditional ethnic music, distinguished from popular music. Yet within classical music, which spans generally the medieval ages to music composed today, there is also a classical period that refers roughly to the period of 1750 to 1820. So it's all really quite confusing. You know, I'm not well versed in jazz or pop music, so I looked up subgenres in rock and jazz on Wikipedia and found that there are about 20 in rock music and about 40 in jazz. Anyway, when we practice an instrument, we consider many things. How we produce sound on our instruments, why we have chosen to produce a certain sound, its color, intensity, volume, shape, and articulation. We must think about the individual note we are playing, the musical phrase it is part of, and the gesture and purpose of that phrase within the entire work we are playing. Similar to the considerations given the syllables of a word in a line of poetry within a poem. As musicians, we must possess physical dexterity and stamina, and plan the efficient use of our energy. We must decide when to take breaths as singers and wind players, and when to take artistic breaths as string players. And unless we are performing all alone on stage, we need to know the music the other musicians are playing. We must listen to what they are doing and simultaneously produce sound ourselves. We must be able to respond to and fit with their spontaneous expression and they with ours. There are moments when it is essential that we all breathe at the same time and in the same way. We must find the balance between our artistic expression, our individuality, and that of the other musicians, and between all of our individual perspectives and the collective goal. In essence, we need to balance our rights and responsibilities. But our roles and responsibilities, to some extent, shift from moment to moment during a piece of music. For example, a cellist could one moment be playing a supporting harmonic line, then the next moment be playing the primary melody, then playing a rhythmic motif, then providing intensity or volume density with one constant note. And often a cellist is doing several of these things at the same time. All of these roles and responsibilities and balances are a lot to consider. And during a concert performance, the music doesn't stop to permit us to make adjustments. It requires expertise. But now we're talking about a different kind of expert, an expert in processes and interactions, an expert in responses and solutions, an expert in integration. However, musicians are not superhumans. We are not a more advanced subset of the human race. When we don't have our instruments in our hands, and even many times when we do, we can struggle with issues of balancing rights and responsibilities, freedom of expression, and thoughtful ways to communicate our desires, giving equal time, patience, and consideration to the feelings and thoughts of others. But we do confront these issues daily. And at least in our professional lives, we usually find sufficiently successful solutions. I don't think most of us, myself certainly included, stop often enough to reflect upon our own functioning, how well we are handling four basic steps or processes: recognize, absorb, interpret, act. As Daniel Kahneman said after writing his recent book about bias, Thinking Fast and Slow, he still struggles with all the biases and conditioning he so brilliantly elucidates. He himself is not immune, but he knows what to look for, the potentially misleading signs and symbols, the cracks in the pavement. Our principal work together during these seminars will be to explore values, processes, and experiences from the field of music, and to consider how and where they might illuminate personal and professional challenges, opportunities, and best practices in the field of human rights. This introductory lecture is entitled The Yin and Yang of Music and Human Rights. And I think, there's the symbol of it. Those of you who have studied Chinese philosophy might be somewhat bewildered by the analogy. I chose the symbol because visually I responded to the sense of motion, fluidity, a feeling of interconnectedness, of different but related, of parts united to form a greater whole, and also of a dance. I did not know its philosophical or practical associations with Asian music, nor was I aware whether there might be meanings that might be inappropriate as an expression of relationships between music and human rights. Having done some research now, I've learned that the original meaning of yin-yang is shady place, or north slope, the yin, and north side of a mountain or hill, and the yang, sunny side, or south slope. Yin and yang symbolize opposites, black and white, female and male, water and fire, earth and heaven, stillness and movement, introvert, extrovert, contracting and expanding, ebb and flow. One of the yin-yang concepts is that opposites are complementary. They cannot exist without each other. No top without a bottom, no inside without an outside, no darkness without light. It is a bipolar concept. Furthermore, they also symbolize opposites that transform into each other. Cycles occurring in nature, such as daytime leading into nighttime, the fertile, mature, tall grain dropping its seed and then dying back, something I excerpted. But music and human rights are not opposites. They do not exist in inverse proportion to each other. One did exist without the other. The songs of birds probably existed long before Homo sapiens. Human music making occurred long before human rights were conceived. The earliest musical instruments discovered, bird bone pipes that are dated between approximately 25,000 to 35,000 years ago. However, drumming probably existed for thousands, if not tens of thousands of years before flute instruments were discovered. And in fact, when we're talking about, Carlotta was mentioning about music used for war more than peace, perhaps in the 19th century, there's little question that drumming in ancient prehistoric times was also used for war, to scare and terrorize the enemy. And so it's music probably has associations historically more negatively than positively, or at least in some balance. And referring to, it made me think, Antonio mentioning the beautiful quality of birdsong, that male finches have very evolved mating calls. And if finches grow up without, male finches without the father around, they don't learn the bird calls and they're not able to find a mate. And they also, apparently, it's recently been discovered, I learned this from Bruce, that they also evolve and change their bird song if they're not successful finding a mate. It's like, let me change my clothes and see if this will be a little more attractive. There are definitely music in that world as well. So I started to wonder whether, instead of yin-yang, whether a better-suited image is the double helix of DNA. There's an example of that. It's intertwined. It's parallel rather than contrary. It's still fluid. Also depiction of the aspects of the natural world and very much dance-like. I am questioning my choice of title here publicly because it raises a recurrent theme in the seminars, which is bias. I believe the naming of this lecture bears elements of bias, including ignorance, which is a form of bias, a rush to formulate a catchy title, which is from an automatic disposition of part of our brain to quickly find coherence without sufficient consideration and be satisfied and move on. Particularly in the lectures Hearing and Listening, which will occur tomorrow, and One in Many Voices, we will be exploring bias born of especially positional bias, the literal physical point of view, as well as perspective more figuratively, as a factor that can limit knowledge, constrict the imagination, whether conscious or unaware. Errors of omission will be looked at, the desire to find a fast solution, or to be accepted by your group. Since I'm using the term bias, I have it defined here as a systematic deviation from the truth, or a systematic distortion from a statistical result due to a factor that's not allowed for in its derivation. It's a big issue in scientific studies that scientists are all often not aware that there is something influencing the outcome that they hadn't accounted for, and the results, therefore, are inaccurate, and they're not aware of it. Prejudice, I define as preconceived opinion that is not based on reason. It says here, or actual experience, dislike, hostility, or unjust behavior deriving from preconceived or unfounded opinions. I think that's a prejudice definition of prejudice, because a lot of prejudice is based on actual experience. A lot of prejudice is quite well founded because of your social milieu or particular experiences, but it is a dislike or hostility, certainly not an impartial view. In his discussion of positionally dependent observations in his book, The Idea of Justice, Amartya Sen quotes Shakespeare's King Lear, "A man may see how this world goes with no eyes, look with thine ears. Sen then goes on to say, and I quote, what we can see is not independent of where we stand in relation to what we are trying to see. And this in turn can influence our beliefs, understanding, and decisions. Positionally dependent observations, beliefs, and choices can be important for the enterprise of knowledge as well as for practical reason. I'm going to start skipping ahead a little bit because this is, I realize, my talk is much longer than allotted time. I'll say that bias is not only cultural, it can be from highly personal experiences, biological or even evolutionary in nature, but their impact upon our thinking and actions are no less significant because of their source. How might this relate to music and human rights? The Berlin Orchestra hired its first woman, the violinist Madeleine Caruso, only in 1982, followed by the clarinetist Sabina Meyer. You know, they don't engage in blind screens, blind hiring, and as a result, they see what the sex is of the applicant. In the United States and many European orchestras now, there's really a blind hiring process. And there are all sorts of studies that show in employment in the U.S., that if you have an English-sounding name versus an African or Muslim-sounding name, you're more likely to be called in for an interview. It just penetrates everywhere. Even if you feel no, I like people from those biases are there, and we have to pay attention to them. You're going to be hearing stories from Alessio Allegrini about bias and discrimination he experienced as a student in Germany, both for being Italian and for playing a French horn made in England, not in Germany. You will also hear about Alessio being physically attacked in the Luzern Festival Orchestra by another musician. His crime? How Alessio articulated two notes he played at the opening of Bruckner's Eighth Symphony. You will hear from Ramsey later today and from Refugee to Refuge about general biases towards music, whether Western or Arabic, music as being a luxury, frivolous. In the lecture Fountain or Stone, we'll also discuss interpretation, bias in interpretation, both in legal texts and musical texts. So whether it's the DNA or it's the yin-yang, it's a bipolar, it's a duality, it's an effort to create simplicity. A lot of the aspects of our primitive biological systems are fight and flee, friend or foe. So there's a reason why these exist historically. But we feel that one of the glorious aspects of music, indeed of all of the arts, is that it can help us acknowledge infinite shades, help us recognize we do not need either to fight or to flee when confronted with the unknown, the bewildering, the uncomfortable. We can remain, we can be silent, we can open ourselves to variety, complexity, ambiguity, the unfamiliar. We may permit intense and conflicting emotions, contradictions, to engage all of our higher capacities, fight within ourselves to achieve a more comprehensive vision, greater understanding, less distance between ourselves and others, a fuller integration within ourselves. This leads me to want to say a few things about the aesthetic encounter, which is so central to engagement with the arts. The arts invite us to consider, to reflect, to participate, to respond. Whether the visual arts, the performing arts, literature, cinema, art can trigger memories, ideas, feelings, images, thoughts. The arts can stimulate meaningful feelings and inspire feelingful thinking. Until relatively recently, whether in the concert hall, theater, cinema, museum, whether indoors or in the open air, the arts have invited us to explore our inner world publicly. Increasingly, first in the electronic age with recordings on cylinders and then 78s and LPs, which means long playing records, I still remember, with radio and television, and now in the digital age with our computers and smartphones, we can also experience the pleasure, drama, and catharsis of the arts in complete privacy. The aesthetic experience is one of confrontation, not with the music, the book, the image, but within ourselves, a confrontation among our several aspects that in the dulling down of daily existence can become segregated, our logical thinking self, our physical perceptions, our intuition, our emotions. An encounter with art can open us up toward reappraisal, reframing, a reunification of past experience and feeling, or completely new insights. How? By temporarily dissolving familiar frames of reference of time and space, by blurring lines, displacing rhythms, introducing unexpected tonalities, presenting ambiguities, discontinuities, illusions, symbols, creating transitional spaces and phenomena where our senses and thoughts and feelings interact with heightened attentiveness. In the effort by our brains to understand, to make patterns out of our confused internal responses to conflicting or previously unencountered stimuli. This heightened level of engagement is, for me, the aesthetic experience. Once this internal dialogue has occurred, once it has been felt, we have become, at least for that moment, more available to ourselves. Then we have the possibility of becoming more available to others. Thus, it seems to me that engagement with the arts is intrinsically tied to the advancement of human rights and human dignity. The aesthetic encounter temporarily removes our internal barriers, creates holes in our protective armor, our conscious prejudices, and our often subconscious biases, permitting our quick, fleet-footed emotions and our slower reasoning selves to dance together. At that moment, we can view and accept our own conflicts and contradictions and honor their presence. We make a step internally toward the other in ourselves, and thus we can make a step externally toward the other. I want to, about aesthetic experience, tie it into some very specific comments by living musicians, practicing musicians. Because aesthetic experience could also lead to other forms of synthesis and to transformations in domains including personal empowerment, internal healing from trauma, progression from anger, guilt, and remorse towards self-awareness, hope, and responsibility, and in the mystical and essential domain of transcendence, finding beauty deep within oneself when there is only darkness and pain. Here are a few quotations. One is from the accordion player Meriba. I have always been fascinated by the Sarajevo Haggadah, not only because of its remarkable history, but also because it reminds me of my own life and the exodus I experienced. I was forced to leave my own country under the strangest and heaviest circumstances. The Haggadah, in its journey, suffered transformations that make it even more special, by giving it a richer history that reflects its passage through different cultures. Like the Haggadah, I also travel around the world. With every journey, I get a new scar, both for the positive and the negative. I keep my dignity. Traveling enriches me through different circumstances, and I share culture with others through my music. The next is from an article in the New York Times just last month about Rawan Okasha, a Palestinian woman living in Gaza. And she has been permitted to perform in Gaza. She's a singer. She's on stage with other musicians. She's on stage with men. She has to stand still. She can't, not really allowed to move around or dance. And she said, "I am achieving what is in my soul. I feel like I have a responsibility to continue singing for the sake of women of my generation." Turns out that Miss Okasha is the eighth of 18 siblings who sing. Her mother, Faiza, said, "Other families make martyrs. I make entertainers." The next quote is from Kenyatta Hughes. He's serving 25 years in Sing Sing prison in upstate New York for murder. In prison, he's studied guitar, keyboard, and now saxophone. During one of the lectures on healing and transformation, we'll play a video of an interview with him, which is deeply moving. He said, "Music gave me a way to say things that I could not articulate in words. There were certain stories I could tell only musically. Through composing music, I have taken an idea that was within me and communicated it so that now it is within the musician performing it. So now we are closer. We are less alone than we were a minute ago. We are a little closer to being one." The final quote is from someone whom Ramsey knows very well. She is a student, has been a student. She's a flutist in the Al-Kamanjati schools that Ramsey created. I read about her in this astonishing book titled Children of the Stone, written by Sandy Tolan, which gives an overview of Ramsey's trajectory and the work he's been doing in Palestine and Lebanon in creating a new generation of people with hope, with skills, with sense of community. This quote is partially from Sandy and then Rasha herself. Rasha is the name of the flutist. "Playing for Rasha became a necessity, and with it came the possibility of facing difficulties that had only recently been overwhelming. When she became angry or anxious, she would play. Her tensions would empty into her instrument and dissolve. It was as if, by holding her flute, she no longer had anything to fear. All her troubles suddenly seemed manageable. When she played, her entire focus was on her flute and on the world she and her instrument made." Quote from Rasha. "I felt like I was in a forest, all by myself in a little cottage, with no people, no noise, nothing. Mountains, sea, something pure blue, not like the Dead Sea. It was an escape to another world, a better world. I owned that world." Although our subject is music and human rights, the aesthetic experience pertains to all art forms. maybe in some of the upcoming lectures I can read some very interesting quotes from poets and artists and psychiatrists that all touch on music. I'd like to turn briefly to music as a universal language. Is it a universal language? I've always had my questions about this, but I think I come out on the right side of the fence. Otherwise, I might get kicked out of here earlier than otherwise. Similar to languages, much music, at least originally, tended to be most thoroughly comprehended within the local or regional culture in which it was created. There is good historical reason, when asked about the languages you speak, that a question is often, what is your native tongue? What is your mother tongue? Even though today the latter question is not so politically correct, with increasing numbers of infant orphans and adoptions by parents who are two women or two men. In music, a primary building block is the scale. In the Western diatonic scale, it typically consists of 12 tones, each about 6% in frequency higher than the preceding tone, comprising an octave. And the specific frequency relationship of an octave is the upper one is double the frequency. There are many 12-tone scales, major, minor, modal. Other cultures have pentatonic with five. Others have different numbers of notes. There are scales that use microtones, which we could think of as fractions in between integers. Music we could perhaps define as sound organized for expressive purposes. We tend not to understand the nuances and complexities of expression in music of other cultures. We also do not often understand them in our own culture across time. For example, as I got involved with the Venice Baroque Orchestra in 1999 after 3 years of playing in and running the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, I realized how little I knew about Baroque music generally and how varied the styles are and musical intentions from country to country, from even regions within countries. We'll be looking at some of that in the lecture, Fountain or Stone, the Spirit of the Law or the Letter of the Law, when we're looking at law cases and also referring to the law as official musical texts. Interestingly, I also talk about Beethoven 9th.
Yes.
saying it's performed on public occasions of tremendous significance in many different countries to represent freedom, determination, perseverance, unity, brotherhood, sisterhood, the triumph of good over evil. But let's step back to the position of Adam Smith's impartial spectator. And note that this piece does not and cannot embody or symbolize the same sentiments for most of the Middle East or Asia or to indigenous peoples, different parts of the world. So I do have some problem with the good feel wash of music over lands and peoples as a universal language uniting us with common understanding. But music is absolutely universal, in my opinion, as a means of expressing the soul, as a means of communicating with family, friends, the community, communicating to neighbors across valleys and mountaintops, and even as a means of warning or scaring your enemies. Music seems to have evolutionary, biological, and social purposes, and perhaps only in the last few thousand years, cultural purposes as well. In the area of evolution and biology, briefly, you know, the aspect of cooperation and coordination, there's, you know, in other primates, the signaling sounds among chimpanzees to alert about eagles and snakes, signaling to coordinate another tribe. Also singing. There's some tribes that sing through the night. And the understanding is that they do this to warn potential attackers that they are awake and that they are alert. So keep your distance. As we mentioned, it plays a role in mating. And interestingly, in biology, it seems that the human brain, and this is also with recent neuroscience, the human brain is biased toward the octave. It appears to exist in all cultures. Infants by 6 months old associate consonants with certain intervals and dissonance with certain other intervals. Across all cultures, parents tend to use four basic musical phrases to express approval or pay attention or stop or to comfort an infant. And I'd like to see if I can play this. This was an astonishing discovery.
Obstetrics unit, which is very popular among expectant mothers.
These mothers came from the wards of this German hospital, and so they were Turkish, they were Greek, they were Sicilian, they were the so-called guest workers in the German society. Of course, I didn't understand a word of what they spoke. As soon as they put the baby down and no longer had the physical contact, bodily contact with the child, they started to sing almost in one language after another.
I book you on the babies.
Dutch.
I heard them use these melodies.
Kusna.
Russian.
Kusna.
To reach the child, to remain in touch with the baby.
F.O.P. Yiddish.
F.O.P.
So the next day I brought my tape recorder.
Below the words, she heard consistently the same melodies. For example,
I'll start with approval.
When a parent wanted to praise a child,
we would ask the parents to show the baby they were happy.
Good boy, now you got it.
Just using their voice, show them you're happy with that.
Das. Acha teri gaadi kidhar hai gaadi?
Hindi.
Gaadi.
Ai, não sabe. Qual é o cavalo?
Portuguese.
É esse, pois. Esse é o cavalo.
And what these things had in common was that the melody was a kind of a rise-fall.
Damn.
Good girl. Good girl.
You got it, yeah. Good girl, sweetie.
So it doesn't matter what words the parents are saying, it's always really about this melody.
There's something about this melody that keeps the child doing something. Now, with a prohibition, in contrast, your goal is to stop the child from doing something.
The category that says stop.
Quite a different melody. It's short.
Stop.
It's sharp.
Stop.
In musical terms, it's staccato.
There is the category of look, pay attention to that.
Mothers frequently use rising pitch.
Nora, look, sweetie.
They frequently use higher pitch.
A unicorn?
So far, Anne Fernald has found four universal melodies that praise, that stop, that call attention, and of course, the melody that comforts.
Oh, Judith, no, non piangere.
And while this may seem obvious to you, if you think about it, this is music that is understood by infants who are just new in the world. But we all know what it means. But we all know these songs.
So I believe music truly is universal. I would like to, I'm going to skip ahead. We've heard about the homologies from Antonio in some of the articles of the Declaration of Human Rights. I found some very interesting things in the 2011 United Nations Declaration on Human Rights Education and Training. And I've come to realize that participation in the study and performance of music, as well as the other performing arts, are an intrinsic involvement with human rights training and education. Without musicians even having knowledge of human rights, one of the aspects is Article 2.2c, Education for Human Rights, which includes empowering persons to enjoy and exercise their rights and to respect and uphold the rights of others. Well, in an ensemble, whether it's a rock group, a jazz combo, or string quartet, the open exchange of ideas and trying the ideas of others, making them your own, asking for advice, accepting criticism, arguing for your beliefs and accommodating the arguments of others. It's the very essence of ensemble collaboration. Music performance is a living, practicing example of human rights in action. The very performance of music is the sonic enactment and embodiment of human rights. Music is human rights in sound. In closing, I'd like to return to the topic of finding one's voice. One of the framing principles of human rights is to recognize the interplay among rights and responsibilities. But perhaps those of us who have the privilege, the luxury of discussing these topics, should consider first our responsibilities and then our rights. As a responsibility, however, I include the obligation to find and honor your own voice, your own conscience, your own values. Please do not confuse this with the idea of being different. Recognizing difference is first and foremost an external exercise. With our mere existence, we are all different anyway. Instead, I am suggesting the idea of recognizing and nurturing your unique qualities, and that is an internal journey. Then ultimately, your contributions to the many individuals, groups, and institutions with whom you will interact will be meaningful to them and fulfilling to you.
Some say, I think, therefore I am. Others say, I feel, therefore I am. Perhaps it's better to consider I should integrate thinking and feeling, as this can lead to human dignity, my own and everyone else's. Thank you.